If you're enjoying this podcast, please consider leaving a rating or review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. It really helps me out a lot. Cheers.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to the Novel Analyst Podcast. My name is Jed Hearn, author of the upcoming fantasy novella Fires of the Dead. And typically it is my job on this podcast to analyze stories I love to help you become a better writer. Today's episode is a little bit different though, because I'm interviewing Gabriel Bergmoser, who's one of my favorite authors. Gabriel Bergmoser is a Melbourne-based author and playwright. After starting out in the youth theatre scene with his early plays Windmills, Life Without Me, and Hometown, Gabriel completed his Masters of Screenwriting at the Victorian College of the Arts, and went on to co-found the independent production company Bitten By Productions. Several of his plays have been published by Australian Plays, and can be listened to online. Links to those in the show notes. In 2015, he won the prestigious Sir Peter Ustinov Television Scriptwriting Award for his pilot screenplay based on Windmills, and he was flown to the International Emmys in New York to accept. In 2016, his first young adult novel, Boone Shepherd, was published by Belfrog Books. It was later shortlisted for the Reading's Young Adult Prize the day after the sequel, Boone Shepherd's American Adventure, was released. The third book, which is my personal favourite, and I've done a podcast on that before, which I'll link to in the show notes, was Boone Shepherd, The Silhouette, and The Sacrifice, and that came out in 2018. From 2015 to 2018, Gabriel was a regular on the popular podcast Movie Maintenance, which is how I discovered him, and he also wrote audio dramas for the now-defunct spin-off show Movie Maintenance Presents. One of those audio dramas, which I've listened to and love, and you should definitely check out, was an adaptation of his play Springsteen, which hit number 3 on the iTunes Performing Arts charts. In 2019, Gabriel signed a 2-book deal with HarperCollins, with the first, The Hunted, also known as Sunburnt Country in the UK when it's published, scheduled for publication in July 2020. The film adaptation is currently being developed in a joint production between Stampede Ventures and Vertigo Entertainment in Los Angeles, with Gabriel writing the screenplay. And now, without further ado, let's get into the interview. Gabe, thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me back.
So we first connected when I interviewed you about a year ago on this very podcast. I believe it was September the 1st that interview was released in 2018. So it's been almost a year since then. How do you think things have changed for you as a writer since then?
I'm gonna go with drastically would probably be the best word for it. When I spoke to you last, the main thing was that Boone Shepherd 3 was about to come out, and you know, I was sort of doing some theater stuff in the backgrounds, and there was some other kind of like, you know, incremental potential developments on a few other projects, including, you know, Windmills, the one that I've kind of been working on for a long time, and you know, like a couple of other things. But yeah, since then I've sort of had a fair few life-changing developments in a very small space of time. So my book Sunburnt Country, which I believe I was sort of like in a very early stages of kind of working on when I spoke to you last time, at least in the form it is currently, that has been bought by HarperCollins in a 2-book deal, and the film rights have sold to. Well, the film rights are being developed. Oh, sorry, the film project is being developed by in a joint production between Stampede Ventures, which is the new production company of Greg Silverman, who was the former head of Warner Brothers, and Vertigo Entertainment, who is that's John Berg and Roy Lee's company, and you know, they worked on things like It, the Lego Movie, The Ring, The Grudge, the How to Train Your Dragon films, The Disaster Artist, like a very eclectic kind of mix of like a lot of films that I really like a lot. So yeah, that all kind of happens very quickly at the start of the year, and it's only the last couple of weeks that all the announcements have been made and that I can actually talk about it publicly.
That's so exciting, man. How do you still like pinch yourself every day when you wake up just to have had that opportunity?
It's like, to be honest, and I've been saying this to a few people, I don't think any of it has really quite hit home yet.
Okay.
It's one of those things where, like, because it all kind of happened so fast, and, like, you know, my whole aim over the last year was essentially to sign with the agent who I've since signed with, my agent who made this happen. They'd seen some work of mine. They'd been like, you know, it's good, but it's not quite there. It's good, but it's not quite there. Like, what else do you have? And so I was kind of back and forthing with them, but my goal was just to sign with them because I knew they were a really good agent. I knew the reputation. I knew that, you know, being with them would be fantastic. And it was kind of, you know, I was only just sort of in the stages of celebrating, finally signing with them when everything kind of erupted, and it all happened so quickly that there was never like, yeah, there was never really a moment where any of it just kind of sunk in. It was just like, you know, being grabbed by the seat of the pants and just kind of thrown into this like chaotic and crazy new world. And, you know, I mean, even just like with the film rights, the film deal, it wasn't until like, I think I saw the Variety and Deadline articles go up last week that I was like, okay, this is really happening. And then, you know, like last night I had dinner with one of the executives from LA who was over in Melbourne, and he kind of took me through sort of what the plan is, like when they're looking at shooting, the talent they want to get attached, all of that kind of stuff. And I mean, I walked out of that meeting like somewhere between like grinning and dancing and then screaming and running away, because like it's one thing when, you know, you're used to, as I am, to kind of, you know, driving your own projects and to, you know, to working in independent theater and stuff. And, you know, you kind of roll your sleeves up and you try to make things happen, but it's not necessarily a very high stakes thing, you know, because it's down to whether you know, the only person who really suffers if it doesn't work is you. But when you kind of look at, in these instances, like the amount of people who are invested in it and who are making it happen and the amount of money that's going into it, and you realize that so much of it kind of rests on you doing your job and not messing it up terribly, that is kind of quite terrifying. But it's also like utterly exhilarating to, you know, to be able to say these things out loud and to be able to say, you know, this is the world I'm now inhabiting. So yeah, it's completely mental, but I don't think I'm, you know, I'm made it to this yet.
Okay. I'm sure hopefully it'll sink in once the movie comes out and it's a massive success.
Well, yeah, well, fingers crossed.
Yeah. Backing up a bit. So you've been writing since, like, I believe, is it 13? Is that correct?
Yeah, consistently since I was about 13.
Consistently since 13. Okay, great. How did you manage to keep resilient through all the years of experiencing rejection from, whether that's the agent you signed with continually sending new projects to them and not getting the response you wanted, or just rejection in other aspects of the writing craft? How did you manage to maintain that desire and that passion for writing throughout that?
Look, delusion, I would say, is the most kind of defining trait I think I've ever had as a writer. And I think that's not, I mean, I think delusion is not necessarily, it's not the worst kind of trait to have, because like if people who wanted to make it as writers were realistic about their chances or knew kind of how hard it would be to get, not only to get your work to a standard where it could potentially be published, but to manage to convince, you know, heavy hitters out there that it is worthwhile. If people were realistic about what that would take, I think most people wouldn't even try. Like, I think if you have to be, like at least a little bit deluded about your chances of making it as an artist in order to make it as an artist. Now, I'm not saying for a second that, you know, like I consider myself as having made it or anything, but, you know, I've kind of entered this sphere now where I'm like, you know, it took, and there are times when that delusion threatens to break. You know, they were like, when I was like 18 or 19, it didn't really matter so much because I was just, you know, I was pumping things out. I was sending it to agents and publishers. I was getting rejection letters. But, you know, in the back of my head, it was always like, you know, you're still young. You're still young. And that's fine. And, you know, like I'm still young now. But I think I put this in a play of mine once that like the biggest lie I think anyone ever told me regarding the creative industries was that you get used to rejection, because if anything, it's the opposite. Like at first, yeah, you get rejected a few times and it hurts a bit, but you get up and you dust it off. And then when you fast forward like 5, 6, 7, 8 years and you're still getting rejected, that's kind of when you reach a point where you're like, why am I trying? You know, like what, like maybe am I wrong? Am I not as good as I thought? Like, do I actually have something worth pursuing, or is this just like a massive fallacy of sunk costs? And like last year, the closest I ever came to just to really giving up would have been like probably September, October last year. And I was never going to, like, I say the closest I ever came, but I guess, like, you know, it's a, if you're going to look at it in writing terms, it was my all is lost moment where, like, you know, within the space of a few weeks, several things collapsed. One of which was, you know, another rejection from the agent. And, you know, they'd always left the door open because, you know, they evidently believed that, like, there was something there. But there was that, and then there was, like, a TV project that, you know, I probably was maybe a bit stupid to think was going to happen, but I kind of had let myself believe it was looking really good. And then there was that rejection. And then there were a couple of other things that all happened within the space of a couple of weeks. And me just sort of lying there staring at the roof, just thinking, honestly, what's the point? And even that feels like a stupid thing to think, because, like, ultimately, you know, like, it's if you set out to be an artist, you can't, like, you can't assume that, you know, you can't, how do I put this? You can't assume that you've been hard done by because you don't achieve the success you think you deserve. Because ultimately, you are beholden to the belief of your audience, but also your publishers, your producers, whatever. And there is nowhere in the rule book of being human that it says people have to take you seriously. Like, you have to be good enough to convince them to take you seriously, and that can be really, really hard to get to. So that kind of makes it a bit tougher, because there's really, if things kind of fall apart like that, there's nothing to get angry at. There's nothing to blame. There's nothing to even get upset at. It's pointless to get upset. You just sort of, like, you just have to get up again and keep going. And I sort of, like, realized after that point, I was like, well, that's just what I'm going to have to do. And the very next thing I did was that I sent the agent Sunburnt Country, which is now will be called in Australia The Hunted. And I sent that to them basically kind of thinking, look, it's completely different to anything else I've sent them. They'll either tell me to go away and never contact them again, or at the very least, it might show them that I can be diverse. You know, I can write different things. I can explore stuff that is dissimilar to what you've already seen. And to my absolute pleasant surprise, they went for it. And then, you know, but even they said at the time, they're like, look, it's really extreme. It's really violent. It's really out there. Like, the bigger publishers probably aren't going to go for it. And then I signed a 2-book deal with HarperCollins. So it just kind of goes to show, you know, that, like, you can't predict anything, and you can't predict, like, what it is that's going to kind of get you over that line and what it is that's going to change your career and change your life. I mean, you know, I had projects in my head that I really thought would be the career makers for me. And like I said to a friend of mine after all this happened, I was like, I never thought it would be Sunburnt Country. Like, I never thought it would be that one. And he just laughed in my face and he was like, dude, I always knew it was going to be Sunburnt Country. He's like, it's the most commercial, it's the most original, it's like all this stuff that, you know, I didn't really see. But you know, like, it just kind of goes to show that in some ways, like, I think nobody has a worse instinct for, like, the quality of what a writer writes than the writer themselves.
Yeah, well, absolutely. Like, you're always your own worst critic and all that.
Yeah, and often you can't clearly see what you have that works and what doesn't work.
Mm. Thank you for that. That was really valuable. And I definitely agree with your friend. Like, Sunburnt Country, I first encountered that on, as we've discussed before, the Movie Maintenance Presents episode where you did that. And yeah, even just the, you know, narrated version of the novella that you originally wrote that became Sunburnt Country. Yeah, it just had, like, this great atmospheric quality about it that was really thrilling. So I'm really looking forward to that coming out next year. Backing up a bit more to Boone Shepherd. So when we last talked about that, you said that you kind of had, I don't want to put words in your mouth, so feel free to correct me here, but you said you had almost conflicted feelings about it because it was something you'd worked on for so long. And obviously that with that comes a certain, I suppose, perhaps boredom for the material that you're working on. How do you feel now that the entire trilogy has been out as a complete entity in the world for quite some time?
Look, that was a weird experience for me because, yeah, well, at the time we spoke, I was kind of a bit fed up with it because, you know, like, I'd worked on it for a long time and, you know, obviously I wanted to end my story and I wanted to end on my terms. And I was so lucky that happened and that Bellfrog Books gave it the support to see it through to the end. And so, you know, there was definitely a satisfaction in that. But it's funny because, like, in the lead up to the publication of The Silhouette and Sacrifice, I kind of wasn't really thinking about it that much. Like, I knew it was coming out and everything. And, you know, it was, but like, I'd kind of already in my head moved on to other projects. And it wasn't until the day before publication that I was walking home from Melbourne Young Writers Studio, where I do some teaching, and it just hit me that I wanted to write something about Boone. So I just went to the pub and I sat down and I just wrote this short story that, you know, is in a vague place in the timeline, and it was just kind of a way to say goodbye to Boone. It was like a short story where Boone's being held in the cell, he's going to get hanged the next day because he's pissed off a small town, and you know, like, essentially this little boy comes and visits him, and it's kept, and the little boy kind of comes and says, you know, do you have any regrets? And it's kept a bit vague whether it's happening in bed or if the little boy is meant to be young Boone or if he's somebody else or what. But you know, the story was kind of just a way for me to say goodbye to him. And when I finished writing it, like, I sat there and I had tears in my eyes. And I'd gone from, you know, this place of not ambivalence, but like this place of, you know, feeling like I was done with that world, to then realizing that I was done with the character. And I wrote this sort of last goodbye to him. And then suddenly I was like, oh no, like he's actually gone. Like it's like, the only way I can put it is that for so long, there was a part of my head where Boone Shepherd always was, you know, like, and whether, you know, he came out to do the rewrites on the novels, or whether he came out to write a short story or to be working on a TV show or whatever, like, he was always there. And then after I wrote that short, it hit me like a ton of bricks that he wasn't there anymore. Like, I'd look at where Boone Shepherd was, had been, and it was empty. And, you know, that maybe that sounds esoteric or weird, but it you can't spend that long writing about a character without that character becoming real to you. And Boone was very real to me. And suddenly, like, it maybe it was that kind of, you know, you don't know what you've got till it's gone, but sort of, it was the first time I'd ever completed anything in a way that, you know, there wasn't any room for further additions. You know, like, if you write a play and you finish a play, or you write a novel that hasn't been published yet, like, up until the point that it's printed and it's out in the world, you can do anything with it, you know? Like, you can change it, you can fix it, you can revisit it, you can all of that. But when The Silhouette and Sacrifice came out, with it came the realization that that is the end of Boone Shepherd, you know? And look, I'm not closing the door to revisiting him one day, but right now it feels very much like I said everything I had to say about that character, and I'm very proud of the final book. But that the most surprising thing for me was just the, I don't want to say depression, but I sank into a really weird, like malaise after that final book came out, where, like, for a couple of months there, I was really flat, and I was really down, and I was really unmotivated. And I genuinely think that was realizing that I had to say goodbye to that character and not being as ready as I thought I was to say goodbye. And, you know, it kind of took until things came up with Sunburnt Country, and until, you know, I was... Like, I mean, sometimes, I wrote about this in a blog recently, but sometimes, you know, the characters who are very real to you, and if it feels like they're present or they're around, it can feel like, you know, like they're with you, or they're over your shoulder, or they're walking with you or something. And I felt that with Boone a lot. And it wasn't until, you know, back in maybe January or February, like right before everything kind of erupted, that I was walking home from a friend's house, and I just felt, like, with overwhelming clarity, I felt the presence of Maggie, the protagonist of Sunburnt Country. And I was like, oh, okay, so now it's you and I. Now we're going on adventures. And, yeah, Boone's gone, but now somebody has stepped up to take his place, and the next adventure will be with her. And that was really reassuring. It was kind of a realization that, yeah, the Boone adventure is over, and that's okay, but there will be something new now, and there will be something else. And, you know, I'll never forget Boone. It will always... I mean, Boone Shepherd will always be my first novel, and that's never going to go away. And, you know, I learned so much writing those books. And I'm still immensely proud of the trilogy in a way that I didn't think I would be. You know, I thought a few years would pass, and I'd kind of look back on the first one and think, oh, is it too clumsy? Is it too simplistic? But I'm still so proud to put Boone Shepherd up and say it is my first novel. I'm so proud that was my first series. And I'm so happy that I got to tell the whole story. Like, because there were moments during the run where it looked like there might not be a second one or even a third one. And yet, in the end, the story got to be told. It got out there in the world. People got to see the tale I was trying to tell and the point I was trying to make. And now, looking back at it, I haven't really thought about Boone in a long time because I've been so, so buried in Sunburnt Country. But I'm immensely proud with how it landed and what I ended up with.
What do you think is the biggest thing you learnt from Boone?
Ah, that's a really good question. The biggest thing I learnt from Boone is that you can't force things, that you can't, like, that in writing you know, there were moments when I was trying to do rewrites on, I think it was particularly the second one, the third one, and I think I spoke about this last time, but you know, I couldn't find the voice. I couldn't find Boone and Prometheus' voices. I couldn't kind of tap into the feeling of, like, zaniness that you needed for Boone Shepherd. And then there were a lot of times when I felt that when I was writing it. There were times when, you know, like, I would write, you know, three or four Boone short stories in a row and a screenplay or a TV Bible for when it was being developed as a TV show and everything, and do edits on the novel. And I felt like, you know, I was very much in that world and I had this boundless kind of energy and passion for Boone Shepherd and I could just keep doing it. But then there were times when I just didn't. And I couldn't even sit down and edit the novel with any clarity or any focus because I just couldn't find the voice. And so I sort of realized, well, I've just got to wait for the voice to come back, you know, and I've got to just kind of go with something, you know, when it's time to write something, it will be time to write something. When it's time to stop, it will be time to stop. And so I kind of learned to let the process guide itself instead of pushing things during it. And, you know, like I sort of, after the first one came out and, you know, there was uncertainty as to whether there would be a second one. And then the same thing happened with the third one. And I was like, you know, am I going to like really push to try to get this out there? Or will I just step back and let whatever happens happen? And that's kind of what I did. And it ended up all working out for the best, I think. So yeah, I get like, look, maybe if like I have time to think about it, I'll come up with a better answer. But for now, that would be what I think I really took away from it.
Yeah. Just that, like trying to embrace the voice and not having to like push yourself to.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Excellent. So it seems like you've had a lot of interviews recently. What do you wish more people asked you about? Because I imagine you get asked the same thing over and over.
Oh my God, I have no idea. that's a really good question.
We can come like, back to that I if guess, you need time to think.
Yeah, in the past, you know, I would have said that I wished more people asked me about Boone, and I think that was probably because I was working on Boone so much, but you know, most people's interest in my work was either my theatre work or my podcasting work. And so, you know, and that was okay. Like, you know, I'm not sitting there, you know, railing at people and saying, you know, how did, like, people, you know, ask what people, I think an interview always works best if the interviewer asks what interests them and, you know, if I can hopefully answer in a cogent way. But it's funny because now that the Boone Shepherd experience is kind of over, I find myself having very little to say about it, apart from, you know, my personal experience. But, you know, like, because there was so much I wanted to talk about with the final book and the lead up to it. But now that it's kind of out, I'd be hard pressed to think about what I actually want to say about it, if that makes sense.
That does make a lot of sense, yeah. Especially because there's probably, like, arguably less need to sort of promote it now that, you know, it's already out there and kind of gaining its own following and stuff.
Absolutely.
Yeah, how do you think your writing routine has changed since you've signed the deal with HarperCollins and, you know, since all the big stuff has started happening? Have there been any drastic changes to the way that you go about your writing or editing, or has it still remained more or less the same?
Having money and not having to do freelance is really nice.
Awesome.
So like, I guess in some ways I have more freedom, like in that, you know, I don't have to worry about, at least for the time being, that, you know, without getting into specifics, like thanks to the financial side of it, you know, I'm kind of able to relax. You know, I mean, in the past, I've always had to worry about, particularly since I made the choice to live purely as a writer and to make my money doing freelance and doing creative writing, teaching and those bits and pieces, you know, and having like a mismatch of different income streams. It's kind of nice to be able to sort of just work from home as a writer and not have to worry about, oh, now I have to move on and do that thing, or now I have to move on and do that thing, or now I have to write that freelance thing I don't want to do, or whatever it was. But in terms of like how much I write or the focus I give to writing, it hasn't really changed that much. I mean, like even when I wasn't getting paid, I was, you know, I treated my work as professionally as I could, and I made time to write, and I made writing days, and I gave myself hours to do it and everything. The only difference now is that, like, I guess I have more freedom to work on everything, and I have, I guess, a bit more time. But even that's kind of flawed because now, like, there's a lot more, like, I'm getting a lot more engagements now coming up. Like, I was in Sydney last week for a writer's room on a new TV show. So that kind of, you know, took a week out of my editing and my rewrite schedule for both the book and the screenplay. And then, you know, a couple of other things have come up, and, you know, like, I've got to fly to Sydney like two more times before the end of the month for engagements. And, you know, so it's on the one hand, yeah, there's more freedom, but on the other hand, there's more expected of me in my time now. So I mean, that has certainly shifted things around, but in terms of like drastically, it hasn't really changed my schedule.
That makes a lot of sense. Okay, so yeah, more freedom, but also a lot of that freedom is doing writing stuff, which is its own kind of freedom, I
Yes,
suppose.
exactly. And that's the dream, right? Like, I mean, my
Yeah.
agent warned me, like, when we first went in for the meeting with HarperCollins, she warned me, because, I was like in my head thinking, with that much money, I can do this and I can do this and I can do this and I can, I have this freedom and I have this ability. And Tara was like, you just have to know that they're going to work you really hard. Like, because she's got, because she represents Durbla McTiernan, who wrote The Ruin and The Scholar, which are both with HarperCollins. And, like, there's a lot that I've learnt from the kind of early days of the Harper experience, that like of what is expected of an author in this day and age in terms of promoting their own books and in terms of building up the right relationships and the right connections. So much stuff that I didn't know previously because the Boone experience was on such a small scale. So like I'm already kind of starting to see that it's like, there is a lot expected of your time. And a friend of mine sums up really well where like when it all happened, he said, don't look at this as winning the lottery. Look at this like a full-time job that you're getting paid for in advance. And this has got to be your full-time job for next year. And that's so true. Like, that's how I've been treating it. And like, sort of, as I slowly get an idea of what my schedule is going to be as for the rest of the year, but also early next year in the lead up to release, with conferences, with tours, with all of that. Plus, the UK publication is coming up as well. So I am very aware of the fact that, I'm going to have to make time for that too.
If you don't mind, and we can skip over this if you don't feel comfortable talking about it, but are there any specific tactics that you're using to promote your upcoming book?
At this stage, not so much, but like what I kind of learned when I was in Sydney last week, I had lunch with the sales rep team at HarperCollins, and they kind of took me through like a lot of what goes into selling a book nowadays. And so, I mean, with Boone Shepherd, it was different because most of the promotion was done through being involved with Movie Maintenance. So a lot of the promotion came through that, and the book was predominantly marketed to people who'd like Movie Maintenance for better or worse. I think that there were potentially some mistakes in that approach in retrospect, in that, what people wanted from what people who liked Movie Maintenance might have wanted from me wasn't exactly what Boone Shepherd offered. And I did see that kind of disconnect come up a few times in terms of the responses people had. But now, like looking at it now, it's a lot more about going to bookseller conferences, about meeting booksellers, about meeting the people who are going to be promoting your work and getting out there, about doing sort of as much interviews and press as possible, about basically just kind of making everybody aware of the book to kind of create as much early buzz as humanly possible. So, kind of like, and HarperCollins have a very kind of clever marketing strategy, but so much of it is going to be for them about getting people excited early, about getting excerpts out early, getting advanced copies out early, kind of getting them in the right hands of the right reviewers, of the right booksellers, of the right influencers, of the kinds of people who can sort of start creating some real buzz in the book. I mean, hopefully the book ends up being good enough to warrant that buzz. But yes, so much about it is kind of on the shoulders of the author and on the relationships of the author now. And yeah, I guess I'd never really known that, and it's really interesting to kind of see that's what's so imperative nowadays in terms of how this gets approached.
In terms of the craft of writing, what do you think is the biggest perhaps lesson, or maybe I don't want to use the word difference, but what do you think is the biggest lesson you've learned about the craft of writing over the last year? Or even just working with your agent and with the editors at HarperCollins and stuff. Have they perhaps like given you any new epiphanies or anything
Yeah.
like that?
I had an amazing experience where Catherine Milne, who's the head of fiction at HarperCollins, who acquired The Hunted or Sunburnt Country, she sent me her notes a couple of weeks ago, like on the manuscript that they bought. And it was 18 pages of like, just really solid, like really kind of in-depth notes. And I read through them all, and as I did, my first thought was, this is all solid gold. Like, this is all so good, and it's so helpful, and I get to take credit for all of it, because everybody's going to think these were my ideas. And like, and that was kind of like, it. I think the big thing I've learned, and look, and I learned this with Boone Shepherd as well. April Newton, who edited the Boone Shepherd books, was an awesome collaborator, but like, it was. She was awesome for the Boone books because she got the Boone books, and like having now seen that reinforced by working with Catherine, it is so imperative to have an editor who gets the work
and who is as impassioned about the work as you are. Like, April was 100% the right person to work on Boone Shepherd, and Catherine is 100% the right person to work on The Hunted, because just reading her notes and seeing that, like, we were on exactly the same wavelength, the ideas that she had, the things that she put forward, were just logical things that had me sitting there thinking, I wish I'd thought of that. Like, it's so obvious, and it's so good, and it's going to elevate the book that much. And it not even necessarily, like, major changes, but just enough to kind of really take it to the next level. And yeah, to just, like, to have the right editor and the right agent and to trust them. So that's the other thing as well, is, like, being with Curtis Brown and with Tara Wynn at Curtis, she has been such an incredible advocate and supporter. And again, it just comes down to her getting the book. It comes down to having read the book, having got the book, having understood where it would sit and who would like it. And just kind of, you know, having a team in your corner who are willing to kind of go out to bat for you. And the same goes for Jerry Kalajian, who sold the film rights in LA. You know, somebody who just, like, from the moment I spoke to him on the phone, it was just so obvious that he completely understood what we were working with, and he completely understood the material. And, you know, he was passionate about it, and he advocated for it, and he stood up for it, and he made it happen. He made sure that when the film deal sold, I got the best deal possible. And it's just like, it feels so lovely to be supported, you know, like, and to kind of, you know, be surrounded by professional people who know what they're doing and care about your book. And I think that the lesson I've learned the quickest in this process is just how imperative it is to have that team around you.
Yeah, well, you absolutely deserve it. Like, I've read, you know, early versions of Sunburnt Country when it was the podcast, and I've read a lot of your other stuff. And yeah, like, it's awesome that things are starting to explode.
Thanks, man.
No worries. Tana French, you are a big fan of her.
Oh, yes, I am.
I'd like to... We probably don't have time for the, like, 4,000-word blog post that you wrote on her, which I will link to in the show notes, because it was very interesting. I haven't read any of her stuff. That will probably change. But what do you think is it that appeals to you so much about her writing? Actually, just first, like, give a brief overview so our audience understands who she is and, like, what she's written. And how do you think you're going to sort of implement the lessons you might have learned from her in your own craft?
Tana French is... I mean, it's interesting because at the start of the year, I was reading a lot of Patricia Highsmith. So I was reading the Talented Mr. Ripley books, which are great in a different way. And then I was kind of alternating between reading those and reading Tana French's Dublin Murder Squad, which a friend of mine had got me onto. And it's funny because... from a craft perspective, the books couldn't be more different. Like, Tana French writes in a very lyrical, very beautiful, very evocative way, whereas Patricia Highsmith is quite sparse and spare and direct. And I love both those writing styles for different reasons. And I guess, like, my ideal would be that I would love to be the kind of writer who can marry those two things. Like, I would love to kind of write in a way that sort of had that kind of that sparse directness of a Patricia Highsmith, but occasionally kind of tipped into something more lyrical or more striking or more beautiful. And, you know, I was always, for a long time, I've been somebody who kind of, you know, turns my nose up a bit at overwriting or at trying, or, you know, at purple prose or trying to be. And I think, you know, I think there's a difference between, like, lyrical and beautiful prose and purple over the top, overly showy prose. And Tana French kind of hits the nail on the head perfectly in that, like, when it's necessary, she can bring out the most breathtaking passages of description or of you know, a psychological moment the character's having, and write it in such a way that you find yourself forced to put the book down. The other thing that Tana French has, which I would love to emulate, is an impeccable grasp on character and on how to position characters and on how to build sympathy and empathy for characters who don't necessarily deserve it. And essentially the premise is that every book is about a different detective in the same murder squad. So the first one, In the Woods, is about a detective called Rob Ryan, and he gets investigate this murder in this spot that has real significance to him because 20 years ago when he was a kid, him and his friends were playing in the woods outside of Dublin, and his friends went missing. And he came out covered in blood with no memory of what happened to his friends, no memory of what they went through, just a complete blank in his head where that should be. 20 years later, he's become a detective, and he gets called in to investigate a murder on the same spot. So the question is, are they linked? What happened to his friends? You know, and what's so compelling about In the Woods is the journey that Rob goes on, because at the start of the book, he insists to you as the audience, he's an unreliable narrator in a lot of respects, and he insists to you as the audience that that essentially, you know, that he's fine, you know, like that happened 20 years ago and that was traumatizing, it was horrible, but I'm fine, I'm over it, it's okay, it hasn't affected me in any way. And then over the course of the book, you slowly realize just how wildly untrue that is and just how thoroughly broken he is. And what I loved about In the Woods was that it, instead of kind of, you know, having your quintessential damaged, flawed detective who kind of comes right in the end or can deal with things in the end, Tana French centered the book on a character who was actually quite weak and who can't actually deal with what's going on, and who thinks he can but can't. And I found that so moving and so compelling. And then the most savvy choice she made was that, I think she said in interviews that, that, you know, she loves crime fiction, but she wanted all of her books to center on a case that was defining for that detective, or a case that provided a turning point in the life of the detective. And she rightly said that one detective going through six of those cases would just drive somebody crazy. So instead, in the second book, Rob's partner from the first one, Cassie, becomes the main character. In the third book, Frank Mackey, Cassie's boss in the second book, becomes the main character. In the fourth one, Scorcher Kennedy, who's Frank Mackey's rival, and the third one becomes the main character, and so on and so on. And they're all written in first person. The writing style changes slightly depending on each one. And not only are they page-turning mysteries, but they are amazing psychological portraits of a damaged person forced to confront their worst demons. And then she's written another book that came out last year called The Witch Elm, which is her first book that isn't a part of that series. And The Witch Elm was a book that I found utterly haunting. Like, I finished it and I found the final stretch of that book and where it goes and what it lands on and the ideas it explores to be so chilling and so pertinent, and in the way that the best and most challenging art does, turns a stark mirror up to myself and my own views on things and to my own kind of, my own, I guess, shortcomings in a way that I found really quite troubling. And she just did it, like, with just so, so well, and so with such, like, evident ambition and such power to her work that, you know, I mean, I think that she's probably the best author I've ever read in terms of her consistency, her malleability, and the fact that she can shift between such different characters in a way that seems almost effortless. And every book is so thematically strong. Every book is a great mystery. There's no mistaking one book for the other. They're all very different from each other. And I just wish, I mean, she's big in her native island, but she hasn't, you know, she hasn't kind of blown up in the way that she really should in other territories. And I really think that if anybody has not picked up a Tana French book, they are missing out enormously.
All right, I have to check it out. One of the things that I definitely noticed in your discussion about Tana then was legacy, right? Like, it's a theme that you explore in a lot of your books. And why do you think it appeals to you so much? Why do you think that this notion of, you know, examining the burdens of the past appeals to you as a writer?
That's a really good question. And I think in a lot of ways, I'm an inherently and potentially pathologically nostalgic person, in that, you know, I can really, really struggle to deal with change, and I can really, really struggle to deal with big upheavals where, you know, you realize that one chapter of your life has come to an end. Like, whether it's you're no longer in that job, you're no longer in that relationship, that friendship has ended, whatever it may be. And you know, it could be like where you live, or it could be, you know, the direction you're taking in life. And you know, for me, like, I found, like, I'm somebody who kind of struggled a lot with leaving high school because I was in boarding school. You know, I was, my friends there were my family in a lot of ways. And then when I left school and I kind of moved on and we all went to different universities, it took me a really, really long time to acclimate to the fact that that had changed. And so for a long time, I was extremely obsessively analyzing, you know, why did these friendships fall apart? Why didn't we stay in touch? You know, these friendships obviously weren't as strong as I thought they were. What happened? What did I do? What were my mistakes? What was, and you know, like this weird toxic mix of like wanting to go back to before, but kind of realizing you can't, but also like, you know, examining mistakes and trying to learn from them. And I think to a degree, we are all shaped by our past. We are all shaped by the things that we regret, and we're all shaped by the things that we miss and the things we want to experience again. And, you know, throughout life, I think happiness ebbs and flows. You know, we have times in the past that are glorious and beautiful, and we look back and we say that was one of the best times of our lives. And it can be quite difficult to realize that that time's over. And that was kind of, I think, what I felt leaving school, was that, like, you know, this time when I was surrounded by people who I was so close to, who I valued so much, and I was in this world where I had autonomy because I wasn't at home, and like all of that. And then when that kind of ended, it took me a long time to accept that. It took me a really long time to kind of accept that that experience had shaped me, but that experience was over. And the same thing goes for the mistakes you make in the past, and the things that you do that you wish you hadn't done, or the things that you do that, you know, maybe hurt somebody, or you know, or tripped you up in some way, or led to things that personally didn't work well for you. And I'm so fascinated by the ways in which our experiences, both positive and shape and change us, and how ultimately we are all, to a certain extent, the product of everything we've ever experienced. So characters grappling with those past experiences, characters grappling with the events that made them who they are, and whether they regret those events, whether they want those events to change, whether they want to be different, and ergo they want their past to be different, that's something that I'll never not find fascinating. And you know, like, part of it is the fact that I've always been a sucker for a prodigal son story. I mean, like, The Prince of Egypt was my favorite film when I was a kid. And I think now, and I kind of realize that, you know, so many of the themes that I've explored, like Boone Shepherd in particular, it's just like a loosely veiled retelling of The Prince of Egypt. You know, the idea of the guy who runs away from his home, who tries to start a new carefree life, who is drawn back when it turns out that his brother is doing horrible things to innocent people, and it's partly Boone's fault, and he has to step in and change things. You know, the prodigal son story, I think, is so powerful because the story of a character who has run away from the past, who has run away from the things that shape them for better or worse, and then is forced years later to come back and face up to it, that I think is always such a ripe breeding ground for drama. And, you know, in so many ways, whether it's Boone's experiences in Boone Shepherd, whether it's a play like one of my plays like Chris Hawkins or Three Eulogies for Tyson Miller, which is coming up next year, or whether it's something totally different like the Maggie series, all in different ways examine characters who are burdened by their past and are trying to come to terms with that and trying to work out, you know, ultimately, how can you move on to a future that is a blank slate that you can make the most of, but also remember the failures and successes of the past and learn from them.
When you reach the end of your life, what do you hope that your legacy will be as a writer? Like, what do you hope that people will, I guess, like, remember you for or know you for? And I know that's like a bit of a morbid question and a bit far away, but just bear with me, because I'm just curious as to kind of see what your thoughts are on that.
I would love to be the kind, and I said this to Catherine the other day when I was in Sydney, I would love to be the kind of writer who couldn't be pinned down. I would love to be the kind of writer who, when I look back, I've got, you know, the action pulp of the Maggie series. I've got the kind of the sweeping Shakespearean saga of something like Windmills. I've got the whimsical adventure of Boone Shepherd. I've got, you know, a lot of my theatre work, which is kind of more personal and introspective. All of those things, I would love to be known for having successfully straddled not only different genres, but different mediums, you know, having done film, having done television, having done novels, having maybe done comics at some stage, having done podcasting. But what I would love is that I would love to every genre I move through, I've at least managed to see something powerful and personal and meaningful. And I guess I would love to just be known as somebody who had managed successfully to move between those different things and to leave a body of work that explores themes that are powerful to people and do speak to people and do hopefully kind of resonate in the way that good art always should. Obviously, that's all super ambitious. I mean, you can writing something is only one half of the equation. People have to read it, they have to like it, they have to respond to it, and there's no way to be sure that that's ever going to happen in the way that you want it to or you wish it would. But yeah, if I had to kind of say this is my ideal, this is where I'd want to end up, then very much that.
Why do you love writing?
When I was a kid, I used to become extraordinarily fixated on the stories I loved. You know, like whether it was Lord of the Rings, whether it was The Prince of Egypt, whether it was Tomorrow When the War Began, whether it was, you know, A Serious Unfortunate Events, Harry Potter, any of those things, you know, I would become so deeply obsessed with those stories. Like, I would want to live and breathe them. I would read them over and over again. The characters would be so real to me. And particularly, you know, if I was growing up, I was having a hard time at school or something, you know, it's a cliche, you know, you can look and there are your friends and there are the characters and there's all of that. But there was always a loneliness and a disconnect to that because my love for stories was so much that it became quite confronting to realize that, to kind of have to deal with the discomfort of knowing that the degree to which I loved the stories would never quite be enough because the stories would never be mine. You know, like, these weren't my characters, these weren't my worlds, these weren't my ideas. And ultimately I reached a place where I was like, if I want to really love and connect to a story in a way that I can own and I can inhabit completely, then I have to write my own. And to me, it's just that, it's that magic of sitting down and falling through the computer screen and just, you know, of telling a story, of inhabiting a character, of going on an adventure, of seeing a different world, of exploring ideas that you find meaningful, and also just like the superficial thrill of when, you know, you write a moment that you know people are going to be talking about, or you write a twist that you think is going to shock people. And having had the benefit of sitting in theaters while one of my plays is on, and there is nothing quite as satisfying as, you know, hearing the gasps when one of your twists lands, or hearing audiences laughing their heads off at like these little quips that you wrote, and kind of having that feeling that you have the audience in the palm of your hands. That feeling of like, you know, I've got them, I'm pulling the puppet strings, and there's a weird like God complex to the idea that, like, you know, I'm almost like guiding your emotions. You know, that's a terrible way to put it. I shouldn't have even said that.
No, I love that. That's great.
But there is something to, you know, to really, do I get to go on these journeys, but I get to take other people with me. And if I'm doing my job right, I'm wrapping them up in the stories in a way that hopefully means as much to some people as the stories that I read and loved when I was a kid meant to me. And that, you know, that's the ideal. I mean, there's so much about writing that I love, and there's so much I could get into it, but ultimately it's just, I couldn't not do it. You know, there's no, nothing brings me as much joy, as much satisfaction, as much pride as having written a story that somebody has appreciated.
So a couple of quick rapid fire questions, and then we'll get into a bit of a discussion about Sunburnt Country. What do you think is your most underrated story that you've written that you think is really good and that hasn't been like read or watched or listened to by enough people?
I guess, you know, it's probably, it's a hard one, but in some ways there was my play that came out a couple of years ago that everybody who worked on that did an amazing job. And I think the commune really deserved and deserves on it, given not just my work, the work the director did. Like, it was probably at that time. And in fact, you know what? Like, I think in some ways the commune was probably the best ever production of one of my plays, but it really struggled to find audiences. I don't know why that was. I don't know if it's the time of year it went on. I don't know if it's the subject matter. I don't know what it is. Like, and unfortunately, you know, like Heroes was a similar case where, like, Heroes didn't do that well in its original theatre run, but it did extremely well when it came out as a radio play, and extremely well when it went on the one-act play circuit and toured and won a whole bunch of awards. So I kind of felt like, you know, Heroes ended up getting its dues and getting the attention it deserved. And The Commune never did, and that was a bit of a shame to me. And unfortunately, it was never done as a radio play either, so it didn't... unfortunately, wasn't able to kind of reach the wider audience that Heroes eventually got to reach, or whatever else. So that would be one. The other one, weirdly, given that we've just been talking about it, would be Boone Shepherd 3. Like, I would... I haven't heard that much from people about the third Boone Shepherd, and I think part of that is the fact that, obviously, most of the people who read the first one read it through Sans Pants Radio, through the audiobook, and the second one had the audiobook release as well. So I think that made it accessible to a huge chunk of my audiences. And, you know, I mean, the third one sold okay, and it's moving okay and everything, but I guess I just haven't heard as much from people about their feelings on it as I was kind of hoping for. So I don't know if that just means that people are finishing it and just don't really have anything to say about it, or if people are finishing it and you know, or not liking it, or if people just aren't rereading it, or if the audience it's predominantly reaching is kids, which is great, because that's the main audience it's kind of going for. But, you know, I felt like there was a lot of conversation, a lot of discussion about the first two books, particularly the first one, and part of that was due to the way it was released. But I guess I would have, you know, I mean, and maybe it's still to come, like, the book's not even a year old yet, but, like, maybe I would have just liked to have heard more about just, like, what people thought of Boone Shepherd. Did it land for people? Were they happy with the ending? Did they enjoy it? Did they kind of did they find it satisfying? Did they find it interesting? And that's why it was really great to hear your podcast coverage of it, because that kind of did give me some of that of listening and being like, okay, cool, it did work. Like, you know, it did hit the beats I wanted to hit. It did land in the way I think I wanted to land. And so that was really nice, kind of listening to that. And you know, thanks for covering it on the show. And but yeah, I guess yeah, if there was anything, it would just like, I just kind of, you know, probably wouldn't have minded that to kind of get a bit more attention, just because I was proud of it, and I was proud of it as the conclusion to a lot of what was set up in 1 and 2. And I don't think you really get the full story unless you read the whole trilogy.
Absolutely. And yeah, I'll link to that podcast episode. And I definitely feel that the third one was, for me, my favorite in the series. So yeah, I'm sure that'll get there. What story have you read recently that surprised you the most?
The Witch Elm by Tana French.
Witch Elm? Cool. Yep.
Because that book, like, it was, I would say that The Witch Elm was a flawed masterpiece, in that it's not her best book in terms of, you know, hitting. It's a bit uneven at parts, and it's a bit kind of thematically unfocused at parts, but the sheer ambition of what she was grappling with and where it went in the third act in a way that was so deeply disturbing and yet somehow so inevitable at the same time. I wouldn't go as far as to say it was a twist, but it was a turn that when I got to it, I was reading it thinking, this is not what I expected, and this is really disturbing and is really quite chilling. And it was a book that, even though, like, I maybe didn't enjoy it as much as I'd enjoyed some of her other books, it certainly stuck with me a lot more than some of the ones that I'd enjoyed more on a surface level.
What are three words that you would like people to use to describe your writing?
Oh, God, that's tough. That's that's really tough. Surprising would be one. Like, I'd really like to think that, you know, I write things that maybe don't go the way somebody expects, or, you know, maybe turn some characters and some ideas on their heads in ways that are surprising. Weirdly, I would say, like, maybe easy, like in the easy to read. Like, you know, you can just tear through it and it's not a struggle, or it's not too dense. And gripping. Obviously, I think every author subconsciously or not so subconsciously wants to be told that their work's gripping, or that what they're writing, you know, grabs an audience and has a hold on them, because ultimately that's what we want, because that's why we write, is that, you know, we read books that gripped us and enraptured us and completely drew us in when we were younger. And you know, I mean, I think ultimately I could kind of take or leave all the other adjectives, but if I knew that my writing was gripping people, then that's kind of enough to be satisfied with, you know? Like, you can't really ask much more than that as a storyteller.
How do you craft that level of suspense and grippingness in your own writing? Can you think of anything specific you do, or is it just more of a subconscious thing?
I interrogate my stories, and I try to make my work very lean. I try to interrogate everything and try to make sure that there's nothing in there that doesn't need to be there, and to make sure that, you know, the stakes are either high from a personal standpoint or from a life and death standpoint, and to kind of, you know, have like little cliffhangers at the end of every chapter, you know, have like little twists and turns and explosive events here and there. And you know, I try to kind of, as much as I can, I try to take the audience on a roller coaster ride, you know, because that's sort of what I always wanted from a book was, you know, when you don't know what's going to happen next and you want to be surprised by things and you want to be taken to interesting places. And so, you know, I try to kind of use the tricks that I learned from writers I really admire of, you know, keeping big questions in the air, keeping mysteries at play, keeping, you know, a sense of danger and menace here and there, kind of giving haunting little glimpses of the answers to questions that maybe, you know, the audience is kind of grappling with and desperately wants to know where it's going to go. And hopefully not explaining too much, like leaving some things up to the audience's imagination, or leaving some questions unanswered in a way that hopefully keeps them turning over in the audience's head afterwards and during the process of reading it as well. All right. Yeah. But I guess ultimately every writer, as experienced as somebody might be, or as much training as somebody might have, we're all ultimately kind of flying blind, right? You know, it's impossible to anticipate what is going to land for somebody and what is not going to land for somebody, and what the stories that you write that you might think are amazing might not be what your audience or your publisher or your agent thinks are amazing. And that's, you know, so ultimately I think we all just try our best to try to just tell a good yarn. You know, I mean, we can be pretentious about it. We can sort of, you know, talk about craft and all of that. But at the end of the day, like, if it's not making people turn pages, then what's the point?
Absolutely. who are those writing heroes that you like inspired you to begin writing, or you look up to now, apart from obviously Tanner French? Who are the
John
people
Marston.
Who? Oh yeah, keep going.
John Marsden's the big one. J.K. Rowling, John Marsden. I mean, J.K. Rowling, I just think is, and I get really fed up with people criticizing J.K. Rowling for, you know, for retroactively adding too much or for
same.
For all kinds of stuff, and I get annoyed with it because I'm like, you know, it makes me so, and it's similar with John Marston. I might be a bit controversial here, but it's, you know, every time J.K. Rowling does something that, you know, makes people go, oh, you know, that wasn't very woke or whatever. I mean, like, I think she's in an impossible position where she wrote a book series that she started in the 90s, and yes, she didn't include that much diversity or any of that, but, you know, at the time, it wasn't in the public eye. Yeah, she had a blind spot there, and that's. And, like, I think it's pointless to retroactively criticize her for that because, yeah, the point can be made, but the books are out now. And then J.K. Rowling kind of ends up in a situation where she sort of, you know, is tweeting out saying, you know, well, this character's ethnicity is this or this character was this or whatever. And, yeah, maybe it's a misguided retroactive attempt to sort of to add diversity that wasn't there. But, I mean, do you blame her when she's under that much pressure and is copping that much criticism from people about it? I mean, ultimately, I say J.K. Rowling is somebody who has given more to the world than most people. She's donated millions to charity. She has written books that have inspired generations. And, you know, like, at a certain point, what do you expect from somebody? Like, what more could you possibly ask from somebody? It's like, all right, she follows someone a bit dodgy on Twitter, or, you know, she says something that's a bit tone deaf. But at the end of the day, like, she is still trying, and she's still telling stories that enrapture and excite and thrill so many people. I mean, she's probably the best popular storyteller ever in terms of, you know, just her understanding of narrative, of how to craft narrative, and of how to do it in ways that are so compelling and touching and moving and enrapturing. I don't know. I just think she's become a punchline in a way that I think is cruel and a way that I think is utterly unfair. And John Marsden as well, you know, I mean, he recently was in the news for making some unsavory or some allegedly unsavory comments about bullying and about sort of suggesting that it wasn't actually what he said, but, you know, in his new book, he alludes to the fact that bullying isn't always this targeted, horrible thing. It could just be, you know, so if a kid says or does something that annoys his peers and the peers respond badly to that, then, you know, a lot of the times it's that. And, you know, I don't 100% agree with what he was saying, but I also know for a fact, having been to his writing camp, that when I was 12 years old and I was being bullied and I broke down in tears in front of John Marsden, he comforted me, he spoke to me, he gave me advice, and he cared and he listened. And so all the people out there who are, you know, like, having a go at him, again, not only has he written books that have inspired generations, but he has opened two schools, he's done huge amounts of youth work, he's done more to help the youth of this country than so many people. Like, I just think people on Twitter need to shut up sometimes, you know?
Fair
and
call.
So, you know, like, yeah, John Marsden, J.K. Rowling, Thomas Harris, obviously we spoke about him last time, Daniel Handler, Lemony Snicket, so many of those people were the heroes I had growing up who I think really helped shape my own voice and my own ideas.
So moving on to Sunburn Country now, because I'm conscious of your time, so we'll probably wrap this up soon. For those who aren't aware of what Sunburn Country / The Hunted is, I always keep calling it Sunburn Country, I need to change that.
So do I, and it's going to be The Hunted, so I need to get used to the other one. But I mean, it's also potentially going to be called Sunburnt Country in the UK and as a film. So I think it's currently okay to veer between the two. But yeah, I probably have to get used to calling it The Hunted predominantly.
Great. So The Hunted / Sunburnt Country, what is it about for people who aren't familiar?
Okay, so the story... So even if you did hear the original version on Sans Radio, which has changed a lot, but that's still kind of... Some of that material is certainly part of the novel now, but it's not the bulk of the novel. It's more like... And it's mostly been like rewritten and reconfigured, but it's sort of flashbacks that kind of are peppered throughout the book. But basically, The Hunted starts on a desolate stretch of highway out in the middle of nowhere, Australia. The character we meet, Frank, is sort of a middle-aged man who essentially has a little bit of a rough, dodgy past. And in some ways, he's kind of essentially serving penance out there. Like, he's by himself, he's enjoying the solitary... Well, not enjoying, but, you know, he's kind of got a self-sought solitude that he exists within. But his granddaughter, who has been causing trouble at school, has recently been sent to stay with him. And so there's a lot of tension there because, like, Frank and the granddaughter don't really have very much to say to each other. The granddaughter's kind of having a rough time at school, and she doesn't know how to connect to her grandfather. She doesn't really want to be there. Frank is doing his best, but doesn't really want her there. And he's kind of doing it because he's trying to reconnect with his family, but, you know, is scared that it's not. So, you know, there's a lot of kind of, you know, tensions and stuff that's set up right at the start. And suddenly, into this mix, in the very first chapter, Frank's in the roadhouse with his granddaughter and with a couple of people who've stopped on the way to get some fuel, and suddenly out the front of the roadhouse, this battered car just comes careening up the front, screeches to a halt, the front door opens, and this girl gets out. And she's completely covered from head to foot in mud and blood. She's limping badly, and she's dragging a shotgun behind her. And all she says is, "Don't call the police." And then she collapses. So the characters are kind of like, what do we do? They bring her in and they sort of, you know, they're trying to work out like what, whether they should call the police. They pick up the phone and all the phone lines have been cut. And they're slowly thinking, what is going on here? What situation have we found ourselves in? And as they kind of try to look after this girl and try to find out what's happened to her, and night falls, from every direction around them come headlights that basically surround the roadhouse and plunge them into a siege. So essentially the story is about these characters, this disparate bunch of characters who don't have much reason to like or trust each other, stuck in this horror situation together and trying to basically survive the night, trying to work out who is this girl, what has she done, why are these people after her, and what are these people capable of. And so throughout this happening, we have flashbacks to what actually happened to this girl and where she came from and what led to this situation. So it's fast, it's frenetic, it's quite short. It's designed to be the kind of thing you can burn through in a night or two. And hopefully, if I've done my job right, it'll be a white-knuckle thrill ride that will make you scream at the pages at a few pertinent moments.
Excellent. I'm so pumped for it. When does it come out?
It comes out July next year.
July next year.
So
awesome.
Just under a year away from now.
That's great. Well, Gabe, I'm going to wrap it up now. Thank you so much for a great chat. I really enjoyed this. Is there anything else that you want to talk about? Anything else that you're working on for the future that you want to have a discussion about?
No, not really at this stage. I've got one of my plays is on at Melbourne Fringe again this year, The Critic. It was on before in 2016. It did really well, and it's coming back with a new cast and a new director, and I haven't really seen any of it yet, but I'm really excited. That opens, I think, on September the 9th at the Butterfly Club as part of Fringe, but if you look it up, it'll come up. But yeah, so that should be really good. The cast are great. The director's great. It's funny. It's fast. It's very different to Sunburnt Country. And that's really the only other thing I've got coming up at the moment that I can talk about.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Gabe. See ya.
Thanks, Jed. All the best.
Thanks so much for listening to the Novel Analyst Podcast. I had a real blast recording this episode, and if you want to listen to that other episode that Gabe and I talked about, the one where I interviewed him last year, you can go to novelanalyst.com and then scroll down to episode number 5. I also have the link to this in the show notes if you just want to click that, and you can listen to us talk about where he was at a year ago with his writing. We talk about Thomas Harris, who wrote Silence of the Lambs and other stuff, and a bunch of other cool writing-related things. So if you really enjoyed this episode, be sure to go check that out as well. Thanks so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.